Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Drought conditions in New Hampshire and throughout New England worsened this week. The debate over whether a secret list of police officers with possible credibility issues should remain confidential played out in the state Supreme Court. And how do New Hampshire police forces do psychological screening when hiring? These and other stories capture the Granite State's attention this past week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. And we're going to start today's show with a chat about the drought. Some parts of New Hampshire got some rain last night, though that is likely not enough to end these drought conditions. With me now to discuss this, NHPR's environment reporter Annie Ropeek and Doug Miner, Forest Ranger Captain with the State Division of Forests and Lands. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah, good morning.
And listeners, we welcome your questions about fire and drought and climate change, which is part of this. Give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. So, Annie, let's start with you. What's the outlook on the state's drought right now?
So as of yesterday, we have 72% of the state that's in a severe drought, which is a class 2 out of a possible 4, although we should note that the state has rarely ever experienced a class 4, so this, you know, is going on about as bad as it gets. And this drought is actually more widespread than our last severe drought, which was in 2016 and 17. Part of the state was in a more severe drought then, but less overall was experiencing exceptionally dry conditions. So right now we have all of New Hampshire and also plenty of Maine, we should note, experiencing some form of moderate or severe drought. It's affecting growers. It's affecting drinking water supplies. We have more than 150 or nearly 150 local water systems that have some kind of outdoor water use restriction in place. And this has been going on really since May, which came after a winter of low snowpack. And then this summer, we had one of the warmest, driest summers on record in much of the region. And as you mentioned, we've been setting plenty of those records in the past 5 years or so as we start to feel the effects of climate change. And this really isn't expected to change anytime soon. The fall is forecast to remain pretty dry, even as we get little bits and bobs of rain here and there. It's not going to really be enough to move the needle on just how sort of deep the dry conditions are at this point.
And Doug Miner, how do wildfires, which are a concern when drought conditions reach this level, usually start here in New Hampshire?
Most of our fires in New Hampshire and even across the country actually are human caused. You know, 9 out of 10 still have some connection back to an individual, whether it be a campfire, discarded smoking materials. We do have some lightning strike fires, but that percentage is very small compared to ones that are actually caused by human involvement, I guess.
And are forests and other areas in New Hampshire more susceptible to wildfires when there's a drought? That may be obvious, but I just want to check with you on that.
Yes, we're starting to get very concerned. We've been monitoring conditions, since May. We've been seeing, we're fortunate this summer that the relative humidity was relatively high despite the conditions, and it kept a lot of our fires much smaller than we would normally see. But we've had a consistent number of fires, average number of fires to date this year, but the acreage is a little bit less than what we would normally see just because we've had that beneficial higher relative humidity to keep the fires smaller.
So we've seen an average number of fires here. They're just bigger this year?
They're smaller this year.
Oh, they're smaller this year.
Because of the relative humidity and lack of winds. But we're actually seeing some changes now in the weather pattern. As Annie mentioned, the long-term forecast, September through October, looks like above normal temperatures. And then September through November, Looks like below normal precip is going to continue. So, you know, our work with the National Weather Service is very important in terms of our fire weather forecasting. So we're in constant contact with them. But it does look a little bleak for the future here as far as any substantial precipitation.
Okay. And how many wildfires per year do we see, generally speaking?
Generally, we see anywhere from 175 to 225 or so a year. They usually burn about 250 acres. That's on an average year. During drought years, we see usually much higher numbers in terms of acreage. But, you know, so far, so good. But the future is definitely concerning with the drought being a huge factor here.
And maybe to you, Annie Ropeek, how would you say wildfires we experience in New Hampshire, how are they different from those that we may be hearing about in California out west?
So my understanding, and Doug should weigh in here, is that one big reason is that our fuels are a lot different here. So the kind of vegetation that we have on the ground, just the sort of patterns of our forests and our open spaces. It's also a lot more densely developed here. You don't have these big areas of just, you know, open brush that can be lit up by a wildfire, at least not in as many parts of the state. And also, we are overall a much more water-rich part of the country. That's the story in the east, whereas the west is historically dry. And that's our climate change story, too. But, you know, we'll talk, I think, in a little bit about why just having more precipitation overall does not necessarily make us less susceptible to these kinds of problems. But if Doug wants to talk a little bit about what we mean by fuels, that would be great.
Yeah, Doug, what do you think? Fuels.
Yeah, so definitely there's a difference in the fuel type, although we do have some similarities. Yeah, the chronic drought in California is one of the bigger factors that affects them. Usually our drought conditions are more on a temporary basis, but we both share the wildland interface concern. The fuel loading generally is higher in California. The different fuel types, pinyon juniper, chaparral, tall grasses. But we also have some somewhat volatile fuels here in New Hampshire. If you remember the Dilley fire back in 2017, you know, it's a typical northern timber type, you know, spruce fir and northern hardwoods. And we easily had 100-foot flame lengths coming off of that fire. Because it was under drought conditions. The trees were under stress. It was on a slope, preheating fuels as the fire burned up the slope. So, you know, I think it was a wake-up call to a lot of people that saw it and expected that that photo was from a western fire, but it's actually something that can occur right here in New Hampshire in the northeast.
Listeners, if you have a question about drought and wildfires in New Hampshire, give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. That's the quickest way to get your question on the air. You could also email, if that's the way you want to do it. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk to Rich in Canterbury. Rich, thank you very much for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I know that out west they've talked about fire suppression being a big problem because of buildup of fuel in the forest. Is that an issue in New Hampshire, or is our ecology so different that we don't have to worry about fuel buildup?
I'll put that to Doug Miner. Doug, what do you think?
Yeah, generally, the forest management that we're seeing in New Hampshire is very valuable in terms of managing some of the fuel load. We do have some areas of the state where like in the Ospe area, Carroll County, where we still have remnants of the pitch pine, scrub oak fuel type, you know, those are managed pretty actively, both by our agency and the Nature Conservancy to manage the fuel loading there. But obviously, we're dealing with a much smaller land mass in terms of New Hampshire versus the significant size of California.
And Doug, what does managing the area look like? Does that have to do with clearing out excess materials that might burst into flame for a lightning strike or for some other reason?
Right. So it'd be managing the lower understory fuels and then taking out some of the dead fuels just to allow access in there for firefighting, creating fire breaks, fire roads, One of the other programs that we're initiating in New Hampshire and we have had for quite a while is the FireWise USA program, where we're encouraging homeowners and land managers to adopt some of those practices as well. Defensible space around structures is a huge part of that, especially with so many homes being situated in the forest setting.
There was a question from Samantha on Twitter who wrote, "Y'all remember the brush fires in New Hampshire a few years ago? One went along the railroad tracks from like Nashua to Manchester. We've been in a drought for months. Trains are going by every few days. How long until there's another fire?" So we may have been focusing on, you know, large forested areas, but what about urban areas, Nashua, Manchester? Is there a risk of brush fires there as well?
Yes, certainly there is. You know, it's a different dynamic once you get into those more urban areas, but we certainly do see brush fires in Manchester. We see them in Nashua. Obviously, you know, it's a different type of firefighting. Access sometimes is a little more difficult, but, you know, essentially the threat or the danger to structure improvements is the same. The more concentrated number of homes and outbuildings and improvements there are in an area, regardless of the size, if we have heavy fuel in those areas, it's still going to be a concern, be a challenge under some circumstances for the fire department to have enough resources to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And Annie Ropeek, how often do fires affect people or property here? We hear a lot about, you know, people being displaced out west. To what extent are people affected here?
So Doug has told me that we have had fires affect property here before. He mentioned the Dilley Fire, which was sort of our last big benchmark for what constitutes a big wildfire out here, in my understanding. So this was in 2017, after our last severe drought. It was in North Woodstock, kind of along the Appalachian Trail. So, you know, here we might need to sort of broaden our concept of what affecting property means. It closed a couple of really popular recreational areas up there. It wasn't in, you know, a neighborhood per se, but I think that, you know, many people would consider impacts to the AT to be disruptive to sort of how society works in New Hampshire. And also, you know, I know that several of the sort of small little very contained pop-up fires that we've had just this week, Doug has told me, have been in the southern and central parts of the state. And again, these can still be in a relatively remote area, maybe a campfire or a lightning strike, you know, out in the woods. There was one in Hanover last weekend, but it just takes one of those to spread, you know, and there are plenty of people who live in relatively rural areas in New Hampshire who could sort of border those areas. But I'd love for Doug to speak to just any sort of historical info we have on how many times fires really have come into more developed areas.
Doug?
Yeah, most of the time, you know, we're pretty fortunate the fire department has a pretty quick response throughout. But we have lost internal structures, sheds and garages, as well as a few homes over the years that were lost to water. But I think we're almost at an anniversary point of the 1947. Pretty significant conditions prior to 47 fires was very similar to what we've been experiencing this year. Those fires were in October in New Hampshire alone. We lost 15,000 acres, but more of the concern, I guess, or destruction that occurred in Maine was well over 200,000 acres burned, whole towns consumed, 16 million property loss. Mm-hmm. Now, there certainly is a potential. The drought is the key component. Most of the devastating that we have seen here on the East Coast have been associated with you know, extreme drought.
Most of the fires have been associated with extreme drought, is what you said. We're having a little bit of difficulty with your line, Doug. We'll hope it improves in the next few minutes or so. In the meantime, I want to take a call from Tom in Gilmanton. Tom, thank you very much. You've got a question.
I do. Thank you. I'm seeing a lot of the emerald ash borer damage in central New Hampshire, and including our own 25 acres of woodland at home, and I'm wondering if the dead ash represents a significant increase in fuel load and fire risk as a result of the emerald ash borer.
Good question. Thank you very much, Tom. Doug Miner, have you heard of any kind of contributions to this scenario from the emerald ash borer, the invasive pest?
Yeah, obviously. The emerald ash borer is going to result in some mortality. They're generally with our hardwoods, if they were left there naturally, the risk of fire is a little bit less in the long term, but in the short term, it would definitely be a concern. Obviously going in and trying to salvage the dying trees and utilizing them for firewood would certainly be a good use of that resource. But eventually, under normal conditions, once we get the dead and dying wood down on the ground in contact with the soil, it tends to start to decompose, relatively quickly. But that only happens when we have normal moisture levels. And obviously, this year, we're not at that normal level.
Let's go to the phones again and talk to Jackie in Thornton. Jackie, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, yes. I have a question for the speakers regarding the use of or the lack of restriction of use of fireworks in the White Mountain area. Our town of Thornton has no restrictions on the use of fireworks. And wondering how do the speakers feel about that in regard to the dangers of fire, but also the exhaust that's given off from these fireworks that are given, that are set off on a regular basis, at least weekly, in some of the areas of our town.
Thank you, Jackie. Let's put it to Doug, because our time is short. Doug, what do you think? Fireworks as a contributor to wildfires during drought conditions?
Certainly we've had situations where fireworks have kindled wildland fires. As far as regulation of fireworks, they do not fall under the forestry statutes. They're actually addressed under the state fire marshal's statutes. But it's my understanding that communities can regulate the fireworks usage at the local level should they choose to do that. So if there's enough interest, then that may be something that they should consider.
And Annie Ropeek, on the question of climate change, how is this connected to climate change? Are we seeing more years like this over time, or can we expect to?
Yeah, I just want to address the question of whether firework emissions.
Oh, sure, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I did a quick Google search. It's a really interesting question, one I haven't considered. And the lifestyle site Treehugger says that fireworks in the U.S. emit about 60,000 metric tons of carbon every year, which is a little more than what 12,000 gas-powered cars emit in a year. So, I mean, significance is relative, but that is a fair number of cars worth of carbon. So that's interesting to consider. As far as climate change and drought and fire generally, the story in the Northeast that we usually hear for climate change is one of more precipitation, of getting wetter overall. Like I said, we're water rich here. We're not the Southwest where you're expected to see, years and decades of drought and just complete sort of desert conditions, frankly, that are really sensitive to fire in those sort of bigger picture ways. But our story here is also one of volatility. So we're getting these huge dumps of precipitation, heavier extreme precipitation events, but then long bouts of dryness in between them like we've seen this year. We've had some huge soaking rains this year, but then in between you'll go days or weeks with no precipitation, and that's really not a good system to recharge our groundwater, our surface water supplies. Sometimes if you put too much rain into a system at once, it can't really absorb it, so you're not getting as much out of that as you would out of a little bit of rain over a sustained period. And so that sets us up, like Doug is saying, for these shorter term potential drought conditions, more seasonal, surely, but, with our heavier, more sporadic, kind of more volatile precipitation events are going to come these drier periods. Those set us up for drought. Other sort of climate conditions and adjacent conditions like development, like invasive species, as the caller pointed out, all set up our forests to be more vulnerable to just all kinds of damages. And fires are certainly one of those.
We get this comment from Megan in Concord. I travel extensively throughout southern New Hampshire and the seacoast for work. I have seen very little acknowledgement of these drought conditions, with the exception of a large traffic sign in Dover. I also haven't seen a lot of mention of this on the news. I'm wondering if local towns and counties are actively working to conserve water on the community level. Annie Ropick, I believe you mentioned earlier in the program that there are 150 or so towns and municipalities that have some kind of water restriction in place.
Yeah, so the State Department of Environmental Services updates its list every week of, and it's a self-reporting system, so it's not entirely comprehensive, but 159 community water systems serving 320,000 people and six towns with a total population of 47,000 all have water use restrictions in place, and more than 100 of those are mandatory, which means some form of either no outdoor watering, so no watering your lawns and gardens, washing your cars, or only doing it on every other day, or depending on your address, you can do it on certain days. It differs by town, but I think it's true that, you know, the enforcement of this is can be challenging. There are some towns that say if you violate these rules, you are caught doing this, you'll, you know, get a warning, and then you'll get your service shut off if you do it again. I don't know how much that enforcement takes place, and, you know, there's not a ton of employees working in this space. These are not, you know, huge sprawling departments, especially at the local level. So I would wager that it is hard for them to be everywhere at once and to be policing this. And so for people that haven't been paying attention or just don't really understand kind of what's at stake, they may not be listening to that. And I will say, just for what is at stake, the state officials running sort of the drought team that convenes in years like this say that groundwater and well water impacts tend to kind of lag behind the most visible drought conditions. So even if the drought abates in the coming weeks, you're going to see well water depletion happen for longer even after that. And right now the drought is not showing signs of abating. So people with private wells really need to be conservative right now. Stagger your heavy water uses. Try to like alternate days where you're doing, you know, big loads of laundry, that kind of thing. And people who are on town wells need to consider this as a resource. I mean, in the Northeast, we're not used to having water shortages. And, you know, it again, this is not the same story as the Southwest, but right now, our streams and our lakes and our surface waters are running low. Our groundwater is beginning to be affected. And we're all sharing this resource together, and it can be depleted. And as our climate warms and gets drier, or at least gets less snowy and less sort of sustained in its water patterns, that's only going to continue. So people really do need to be aware of this.
That's NHPR's Annie Ropeek. We've also been speaking with Doug Miner, Forest Ranger Captain with the State Division of Forest and Lands. Thank you both very much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. And after a break, transparency about police misconduct being argued before the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Do you have questions about the Lori List? Should it be made public? Why? Email us now, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. Right now, we are speaking about the news of the week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for tuning in. This week, the debate over an as-yet-undisclosed list of police officers with possible credibility issues played out in the state Supreme Court. The Lori List has approximately 250 names of police officers with disciplinary records, and the state says the list was never designed to be made public. Gilles Bissonnette with the ACLU of New Hampshire says the list should be made public, and he's with us now. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So the Lori List is maintained by the Attorney General's office, and as NHPR reported this week, it exists so that defendants and their lawyers in criminal cases can be notified if an officer involved in the case has potential credibility issues. So defense attorneys and defendants for whom this information is arguably most critical already has access to this list. So why should it be even more public and discoverable under the state's right to know law?
Well, I actually think one of the problems, Peter, is that criminal defendants don't have access to the list, nor do their defense lawyers. And in fact, they have to just trust that the system is working properly, that prosecutors are reviewing this list in criminal cases and making appropriate disclosures. And we actually think that's really one of the critical reasons why this list needs to be produced. So defense attorneys can cross-check the list in the middle of criminal cases to help ascertain whether or not they're getting all the information that their defendants are constitutionally entitled to. And I also think it's critical for members of the public because it helps reinforce confidence that the criminal justice system is working in knowing that defendants are getting the information they're supposed to. And if they haven't been receiving that information historically, that also helps the public understand whether or not the system may be in critical need for reform. So with production of the list, not only going forward, we'll be able to determine whether appropriate information is being given, we'll be able to work backwards to see whether or not in prior cases appropriate disclosures have been made.
Mm-hmm. And some have argued that if the list is made public, police departments would be less likely to put officers on the list, and therefore the list would be less complete, less useful. What do you say to that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think we've seen any evidence of that in the case. Certainly we've seen, you know, speculation about that. But I actually think the converse is true, that disclosure will improve the criminal justice system, not hinder it, because disclosing the list is going to help ensure now that prosecutors have made appropriate disclosures and also that the right officers are on the list. So right now, for example, you know, we know of, you know, several officers, many officers who've engaged in misconduct that's kind of percolated through public reporting. We have no way of knowing without access to the list whether those officers are on the list. And so disclosure will help the public ascertain whether or not appropriate officers are on the list.
So of what use to the public is this list, other than just for informing defendants and defense lawyers? Why should the average person have access to this list?
It's really twofold, Peter. I mean, the first is just helping inform taxpayers whether officers that they are paying for with taxpayer dollars have credibility issues in their town. So let me kind of give you an example. So on page 12 of the so-called Lori list, there's one officer that's listed for, quote, cover-up, which, you know, is a pretty serious issue as reflected on the list. So if you're driving through that town and you're stopped by a police officer, you have no way of knowing whether that officer who's stopping you is that officer who is, quote, engaged in cover-up. And in fact, I think that lack of transparency causes that individual and members of the public, whenever they engage a particular officer, to really not necessarily have confidence, because they may think that that officer is that that person that has that credibility or trustworthiness issue. And that really casts suspicion, frankly, over entire departments, including the good officers who are doing their jobs well and with distinction. And I think the second reason why disclosure is necessary is, as I said before, so defendants and members of the public can help determine whether or not disclosures have been made in prior cases, and of course to help ensure that disclosures are made in future cases. I mean, this is a really serious list dealing with sustained misconduct, but it's not just any type of misconduct. It's misconduct addressing truthfulness and credibility. That really goes to the core of an officer's ability to do his or her or their job effectively. I mean, the list itself talks about things like falsifying reports or records, deception, credibility, criminal conduct, deliberate lie during an investigation, and it goes on and on.
And lawyers for the other side have argued that, quote, there's been a lack of uniformity over the years in standards in how one gets on the list and how one gets off. Do you agree with that assessment? Has it been inconsistent, lack of uniformity about how you get on the list in the first place?
I don't know if that's necessarily true. And even if it is true, the correct response is not secrecy. The response is greater transparency. It's releasing the document because we think there's a compelling public interest in disclosure, and informing the public about any issues that the Department of Justice believes exist with respect to the list.
But does that make it harder for the public?
Sorry, go on.
Does that make it harder for the public to understand what being on the list even means if the standards by which, you know, you get you on that list is sort of inconsistent, you know, community by community? Being on the list may mean one thing in Hanover and another thing in Portsmouth, for example.
Yeah, I don't think that is a real good reason to hinder transparency, because what the Department of Justice and law enforcement could do is engage in speech and disclose to the public, hey, public, here is how you should interpret this list. You know, we think there are issues with uniformity, so, you know, don't rush to any conclusions. That is how you address these types of issues. I mean, really no different, Peter, than, you know, police reports, which are incomplete, tell only one side of the story. But we require that they be produced in our public records laws, despite the fact they may be misleading, despite the fact they may create stigma, because we have a transparent criminal justice system. The same should be the case here, because our right to know law basically trusts the public, you know, to with information, even information that may be viewed by some as not necessarily complete. That's how Chapter 91A works. And if folks have concerns with how the list is going to be interpreted by the public, those should be made public as well to help the public make an informed assessment as to what the list means.
Another lawyer arguing for the disclosure of the Lori list said police officers, because of their unique power to arrest, bear a special responsibility to be more transparent than other public employees, like teachers, for example. Is that a sentiment you share?
Absolutely. You know, we're really, I think, Peter, in a historic moment where folks are really concerned about police accountability and transparency. And that's because, you know, unlike teachers, unlike other state employees, law enforcement really have this unique responsibility and unique power to deprive individuals of their liberty, use lethal force, and their testimony alone can cause individuals to go to jail, and in many instances for long periods of time. And I think, you know, with that really, you know, comes a sense of responsibility that when there's misconduct, when there's issues concerning law enforcement, as it relates to credibility and truthfulness, the public really has, I think, a heightened interest in learning that information. And of course, I think when you take a public position, especially one in law enforcement where you have those unique roles, you lose a little bit of that sense of privacy, because you know, you don't work for yourself, you work for the public, and you're paid for by taxpayer dollars. And what comes with that is heightened scrutiny, and rightfully so, I think.
Gilles Bissonnette, legal director for the ACLU of New Hampshire, arguing on behalf of the disclosure of the Lori list. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too. And here are some of the stories NHPR's newsroom has been following this week. A handful of state representatives drank beer and did not wear masks outside of UNH's Whittemore Center in Durham during a legislative session held there. UNH students and staff have criticized this behavior online. UNH President Jim Dean says he's aware that the legislature may want to use the Whittemore Center down the line, but says, quote, "I don't know if we can have that same kind of behavior in the future." House Speaker Steve Shurtleff sent a letter to the dean apologizing for the behavior of those representatives. Also, ramped up testing is leading to the confirmation of more coronavirus cases in New Hampshire, but public health officials stress that the overall spread of the virus doesn't appear to be increasing. While the state had averaged 20 or so new cases a day for most of the summer, the average daily case rate is now around 35. State epidemiologist Benjamin Chan says that's in large part because universities are testing frequently and catching cases early. UNH alone has performed more than 86,000 tests on students and faculty since late July. And the executive committee of the University System Board of Trustees has approved the addition of Juneteenth to the system's holiday schedule. Juneteenth is celebrated on June 19th and commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. The added holiday is subject to collective bargaining agreements. And let's turn now to Ryan Lessard, freelance reporter for the Granite State News Collaborative. He's been reporting on inconsistencies in how New Hampshire police forces do psychological screening when hiring for their forces. Ryan Lessard, thank you for being on the program today.
Good morning, Peter.
So let's talk about these psychological screenings. What are they looking for exactly when they're hiring police officers?
They're looking for a lot of different things. There are numerous tests that officers can take depending on, you know, which clinician the department works through or which mail away test scoring company they hire. And some of the things that they're looking for can include, you know, just simple personality traits, I've heard clinicians, I talked to a few, you know, say that they're looking for officers, you know, on the plus side that are able to have a more, you know, shades of gray worldview. They're wary of people who have that sort of black and white worldview. They're wary of people who are, you know, exhibit rigidity or overconfidence or an inability to see both sides of a situation or solve problems through conversation. And those are some of the personality traits. On top of that, they're also looking for, obviously, some major psychological pathologies and mood disorders that would not be conducive to, you know, the stresses of police work. And some of these tests also just look for honesty. Sometimes they'll have a list of questions that will be set up to sort of catch potential inconsistencies. And if in particular, if an officer is trying to make themselves look too good, you know, by the way they answer certain questions, that'll be raised in the test results as well.
So you're reporting on inconsistencies. You've laid out a lot of things that police departments seem to be looking for with these tests. That's not standardized. It seems like it would be a standardized part of hiring police officers.
Yeah, there are recommendations from the, for example, the International Association of Chiefs of Police has a whole bunch of guidelines on how to not only, you know, to ensure that everybody is getting tested, but it's a little prescriptive on how to, you know, the methods of analysis and disclosure as well. But not everybody follows that. And, you know, in a small state like New Hampshire, we have maybe three different psychologists that do this sort of work. Even between them, there is some variability. You'll find not everybody uses a psychologist. And until last summer, you know, when the legislature passed a police reform bill, you may recall, the one that included the ban on chokeholds, they also closed a loophole that allowed some departments to not do testing at all if they couldn't find the funding for it. They did that essentially by creating a special fund that people can get reimbursement for those tests. You know, communities like Salem will send a form. Basically, the officer or the candidate, rather, who's applying for the job will complete a test, and then they'll send that test to a company out of state. They'll get the scores back you know, and base their recommendations off of that.
So it's what I'm hearing from you, Ryan Lessard, is that it's pretty inconsistent. Some places have funding for it, some places don't, and that there is not really a mechanism to check with police departments to see if this has been done and done thoroughly.
Right. The recent Commission on Police Accountability looked at a lot of these issues, and they walked away with a number of recommendations in their report, which was published late August, and I think endorsed by the governor yesterday or a couple days ago. And some of those recommendations just had to do with ensuring that universal testing was happening, you know, identifying that loophole and making sure that we weren't having officers on the street who weren't getting psychologically evaluated. In addition to that, they recommended greater oversight and regulation, usually through the Police Standards and Training Council, to make sure that that there is universality there. But standardization is a different thing. It would probably take legislation, you know, to require some of these changes. But for example, it is not currently required that every officer who goes through this testing process sits down with a psychologist and does an interview, which, you know, in talking with a lot of police chiefs and a couple clinicians, they say that's a pretty critical step. You know, a lot of things can get missed in a police officer's evaluation if they don't go through that interview process, because they get to get a little deeper. They get to ask about their upbringing, their young adult life, their conflict management history, and their motivations for wanting to be a cop. And a lot of those things are important. And for example, if a red flag comes up on a test, a written test, and they want to know why, you know, that's an opportunity to find out why. They'll ask probing questions in that specific area.
Well, Ryan, we have to leave it there, but Ryan Lessard, freelance reporter for Granite State News Collaborative, thank you very much for coming on the program today and telling us about this really important story. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And still to come, Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ pride flags appeared at a popular climbing spot in the North Country this weekend. Coming up, a conversation about whether or not we should use our natural spaces for such demonstrations. What do you think? Let us know. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
A lot has changed this past year, but NHPR's commitment to serving you has not changed at all.
And as a public radio community, we lean on each other. You rely on us for connection, for accurate, independent journalism when you need it most.
And we rely on you to help sustain this essential community resource.
And right now, when you become an NHPR sustainer at $13 a month,
you can choose to give 13 meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank to help local families in need.
Give now at nhpr.org and thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And in just a little bit, we're going to look at the prospects for the fall leaf peeping season and what that might mean for the New Hampshire economy. If you have a stake in the tourism economy when it comes to leaf peeping season, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. Joining us now is Josh Laskin, freelance photographer and writer. His article in Climbing Magazine titled "Do Demonstrations Belong at Our Crags?" described a display of a huge Black Lives Matter and an LGBTQ pride flag at a popular climbing spot in the North Country over Labor Day weekend. Josh, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the significance of Cathedral Ledge for this display?
Well, Cathedral Ledge for the climbing community is kind of a very central place. It's very significant, has a lot of climbing routes on it, and a lot of those people in the climbing community spend a lot of time there. But in addition to that, it's kind of right in the middle of North Conway, and it gets a lot of attention from tourists. And you know, it's something that when you're in North Conway, you can't miss it. It's right there.
Mm-hmm. And the photos in your article are just quite stunning, and they sort of inspire the fear of heights in a way. You can see these enormous flags draped over what seems to be a very large drop. Can you describe what you photographed?
Yeah, so there was basically a couple of flags hanging up, a Black Lives Matter and a Pride flag. They were pretty big, 12 by 18 feet each, and there was a canoe that was hung up there as well. So you basically had these things kind of hanging up over open air a couple hundred feet up. And then there were a bunch of people up there, a handful of people up there with them, having conversations.
Mm-hmm. And who organized this? Was this a Black Lives Matter event?
So it was really just kind of a couple of climbers in the North Conway community. None of them had anything to do with the Black Lives Matter organization. They were just kind of trying to show support for the overall movement that is taking place. I also think it's important to note that of the people involved, everyone kind of had their own personal reasons for being involved. So there wasn't really one unified message other than kind of trying to create some sort of conversation around this.
I see. And so what were some of those unique reasons? Did they tell you about why they were inspired to do these this demonstration?
Yeah, I mean, some people wanted to show a message of inclusivity in the Mount Washington Valley. Other people just kind of wanted to be there to engage in conversation and raise awareness. I think those were two of the big reasons that people were involved. And, you know, I heard some other smaller reasons as well, but I can't really remember.
Okay. Well, I won't put you on the spot about those, but you did speak to some people who they weren't involved in putting up these flags, but they did, after going out into Cathedral Ledge and into nature and seeing these, they had some opinions about it. What did they tell you?
So I think there were kind of two really big pieces of feedback that we got from people. And one of them was that we were kind of, or the climbers and the people involved were disturbing nature and disturbing a natural landscape. But the question that popped into my mind was, were the people with those criticisms concerned about the natural landscape being disturbed, or were they more concerned with what they perceived the message to be? Because, I mean, Cathedral Ledge, for those who haven't been there, there's a road that goes right to the top. There is a parking lot up top. On any given day, there can be, you know, on any given Saturday, there could be hundreds of people up there. I mean, it basically overlooks a Walmart. So I wouldn't really consider it, you know, that pristine nature, that pristine environment. So you have to kind of ask the question as to whether or where that line is of where wilderness begins that should be left untouched. And then there was the other argument of, and back to that, I mean, at the end of the day, all the climbers removed everything, left out. I mean, they were up for about 12 hours and then everything was packed out. Mm-hmm. And then the other argument I kept on hearing is that people go out into nature to kind of escape these things and to escape these conversations and take a break from everything. But I think it's important to realize that not everyone has that opportunity to just kind of escape their realities by going out into the woods.
So it's a political statement to put these things here in particular, to say, no, this problem exists and you're exerting privilege in a way by being able to escape.
Right, exactly. I mean, if a member of the LGBTQ community goes to a climbing area and the person next to them continues to say, oh man, you know, that's gay, that could be seen as offensive, and that's not, they're not, you know, able to escape. So I think like a big takeaway is just kind of trying to start these conversations, which seems like it has kind of happened. You know, these conversations, I've been hearing them going on in our community, and these are conversations that I didn't hear so much, you know, a year ago.
Well, Josh Laskin, freelance photographer and writer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, just a reminder that if you'd like to see the photos he's taken along with his article, we're putting a link up at our website, nhpr.org. Also in the news this week, the New Hampshire House and Senate failed this week to override any of Governor Chris Sununu's 22 vetoes. The vetoed bills include some measures Republicans had supported, but the agenda was heavy with top Democratic priorities, including a paid family leave program, a bill to raise the minimum wage, and a plan to allow online voter registration and no-excuse absentee voting. With a two-thirds majority needed to override some Republicans would have needed to break rank with Sununu, and not enough did that to override any of his vetoes. Also, school districts will be getting less money from the federal government than they were expected to this fall to cover COVID-related expenses. Many schools were expecting reimbursement from FEMA for materials including PPE, plastic desk barriers, and cleaning supplies. But FEMA changed course this last week, leaving some districts to look for hundreds of thousands of dollars elsewhere to cover COVID-related expenses. And well, we're halfway through September. The air is getting chilly, and soon Granite Staters and out-of-staters alike will don their fall coats and head out for fall leaf peeping. But what is the tourist season going to look like during the pandemic? Joining us now, Meg McIntyre, freelance writer for the Granite State News Collaborative. Meg, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks, Peter. Happy to be here.
So you reported on expectations for a big source of income for the state, fall leaf peeping, still early, but what is the state expecting of this tourist season during a pandemic?
Well, kind of looking to, you know, what happened over the summer, in July and August, the tourist industry did appear to perform pretty strongly based on the state rooms and meals tax and some anecdotal feedback from businesses. But the New Hampshire Division of Travel and Tourism Development has basically said that they're not trying to forecast the number of visitors that are going to be coming this fall, simply because there are just too many variables with COVID and that it's just too difficult to say really what the season will look like. But there are precautions in place. Visitors from outside of New England are required to quarantine for 14 days before they arrive, and they have to fill out documentation to that effect wherever they're staying, whether that be a hotel, Airbnb, some other type of rental. And the division also has a webpage with information about the COVID restrictions, quarantine requirements, what types of businesses are open and what kinds of restrictions they're operating under, as well as which towns have mask mandates, as there's no statewide mask mandate in New Hampshire. And this summer, they also had an outreach campaign with businesses called Don't Go Viral, where they had online resources like posters to download, reminding customers and visitors to wear masks, social distance, all that. And they're hoping to continue that into the fall season as well.
But what about those big tour buses winding along the Kankamegas Highway? You know, people stuffed into one vehicle together, generally frowned upon during the pandemic. What's the prospect for those businesses?
Well, I did hear from, one business, Castle in the Clouds in Moultonboro, which is it's a historic mansion and estate. They have, you know, tours, hiking, outdoor activities, and a lot of their traffic tends to come from some of those big bus tours that are coming down the Kankamegas Highway. And they said pretty much all of those tours have canceled for the fall. So they're seeing a big drop in visitation as a result of that. This summer, they saw a drop of about 50%. And they're expecting a similar scenario this fall. So it appears that, you know, some of those bus tours are just not going to be happening this summer, and it might be this fall. And it might be more likely that people are going to be, taking their own cars, maybe doing some of the scenic drives on their own.
And what about state parks? Are those going to be an option this fall?
Yes, actually, this is the first year that state parks and campgrounds are going to be staying open a bit later into the season. The Division of Parks and Recreation told me that they started considering doing that last year after the foliage season was so popular. And so most of the day use parks are going to be staying open until the end of September, while some of the campgrounds will be open through Columbus Day weekend, which is usually kind of the big weekend for leaf peepers. And throughout the pandemic, they've been operating on a reservation system, which has, you know, sort of allowed the division to track visitation, especially at those popular areas like Mount Monadnock and Jaffrey, which saw kind of a surge of hikers early in the pandemic. And they're talking about actually continuing that reservation system for some of the parks after the pandemic has subsided, because that has been so successful so far. So visitation overall has been down, but much less than the division originally expected.
And what about businesses that host weddings or other large gatherings? What are they expecting this fall?
Well, we're hearing that a lot of the fall weddings, popular during the foliage season, have been canceled or postponed, possibly to next year. I did talk to Aldworth Manor in Harrisville, which is a popular destination for fall weddings, and they told me that all but two or three of their fall events had canceled. And so they're really looking at a much slower season this year. They are expecting to see, you know, some leaf peepers still coming through to stay or eat at their restaurant. But the owner there told me that this has actually been the worst year yet for that location. Castle in the Clouds also has seen a big drop in their weddings. And they've actually turned to some grant funding and the Paycheck Protection Program to kind of help them bolster their finances. So a lot of those venues are really looking to next year, hoping that they'll be able to kind of gain some ground back next foliage season if things have sort of calmed down by that point.
Meg McIntyre, freelance journalist with the Granite State News Collaborative, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And that's it for the roundup today. But just a reminder that you can find all the stories we discussed, links to them at our website, nhpr.org. Jessica Hunt produced the show today, and the engineer is Dan Colgan. Lane Loft answered the phones, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.